tonight on Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. It's Wellness Wednesday.
I come to Chicago often, and I need to do these stairs with you. They're very important.
I just swallowed my tongue.
So we have Dr. Kathy Tynes, and to have an important conversation from ChildServe, we bring on Dan Katowski. We also have Dr. Henry Kamerling, who's a professor of American history. And to continue with Wellness Wednesday, we have Melissa Orth Frey, who is a great trainer here in Chicago, along with screenwriter, director, and author S. Craig Zoller. And be sure to get your calls in at 1 a.m. for Dr. Lars Dingman, the iTunes psychic. But now, live here on WGN Radio, the one and only Patty Vasquez.
In the United States, you are statistically more likely to die from a gunshot wound than dying while riding in a car, van, or truck. You have a 1 in 315 lifetime chance of death from gun violence. These are the numbers from the National Safety Council. The Constitution has a Second Amendment, and we all know that. That's something we've been talking about not just this week, not in the last year, not the last time there was a shooting. We talk about this all the time. A well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. In the Declaration of Independence, we also hold these truths to be evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the Second Amendment is infringing on that right now, and I don't know how you don't have a conversation that isn't impassioned on the side of keeping our children safe, keeping our neighbors safe. And it will now, from now on, it will always be time to talk about gun violence. There will not be, it's too soon. You know what? You know when it's, when we stop talking about it? When we know our children are safe, when they go to school. Joining me in studio is Senator Dan, he's former Senator Dan Katowski, but you always address a senator by their a politician by their last held office. For 6 years, he worked with an organization to help stop gun violence. He served in the state of Illinois, kept the debate going, worked very hard to do his best to make sure that kids were not gunned down on their blocks in their schools, that there were reasonable practices is put in place. Senator Katowski, how are you doing tonight?
Great. How are you?
I'm very well.
Excellent.
Out of the gate.
Yes.
Let's do this.
Yeah, I was just thinking about when I was in the Senate right after Virginia Tech, the shooting occurred. I remember how furious and overwhelmed and just, focused on trying to get something done. And then what we recognize in the state of Illinois, there is a major, there was a major loophole as related to mental illness. And the gun industry in their lobby was completely silent on this. But it was basically a measure that when you buy a gun in the state of Illinois, if you had been considered to be in a clinical setting, determined to be a threat to yourself or to someone in your community, because there'd be a danger, a risk, you would no longer be able to receive a firearm owner's identification card. And thereby, you would not be able to buy a gun from a legal source. And what we found was that is a byproduct that there was a lot of data and information out there about mental health that wasn't being shared through the Department of Human Services to the Illinois State Police. And it was just a minor provision, but it was one of these things where I was struck by this. I was talking to a law enforcement friend of mine this week that the gun industry and their lobby, or they were completely silent on it. And I find it kind of ironic now that they often talk about, oh, it's mental health, it's mental health, it's mental health. Well, this is a big deal from a mental health standpoint. And if you look at this issue, I just like this is on a micro level, but to look at the macro implications of it, only 15% of the mental health data is in the National Instant Check system.
That National Instant Check is for gun ownership?
For potential gun owners, gun buyers.
Okay.
And that's when someone could, when you go to make a gun purchase through a federal firearms licensee, they call up the National Instant Check system, and there's only 15% of the mental health data. There are a lot of states that don't share that data with the National Instant Check system, unlike Illinois, that has a really a better record of doing that. But despite the fact that we have a strong record of doing that, we only have about 50% of the mental health data. But so the reason why I state this is because so much of the conversation that people will say, well, you really need to do something about mental health. Well, we all agree on that. There's so many points that we agree on the issue. Yes, we do need to do something about mental health.
And not just after a shooting. All the time we need to do something about mental health.
And you need to invest in mental health. Yes, we all agree with that. But what's interesting is all of those apparatuses, and that's just an example of the legal source of firearms. The legal source of firearms has not been tightened and confronted the way most other legal sources of consumer distribution are tightened and regulated. And it's just it's an important component to know, because we are lacking so much information about the legal market that we should know. You know, for example, we do not have regulations nationwide on person-to-person gun sales. We don't require background checks on person-to-person gun sales. And most people who are law-abiding citizens and gun owners and people who are passionate about this issue would acknowledge, oh my God, we should do something about this. Why aren't there background checks? I mean, if we want to prevent people who have if they have a history of a mental illness, or they have a challenge related to their criminal past, we don't want them getting guns. And so people should say, look, we want a background check to be done on a person-to-person gun sale. That's essential. But the other thing is, like, what's lost in this conversation is really focusing on the big picture. The gun industry is the last unregulated consumer industry in the United States of America. Like, if you make teddy bears in the United States of America, you have to pass 4 tests, you know, sharp edges and parts, loose parts, hazardous materials, and flammability, right? So there were 2 teddy bears that were recalled in 2013 because they presented a danger to children. They presented a danger to children. We acted as a country to recall these teddy bears. And so the industry is essentially able to produce weaponry year in, year out without that kind of accountability. So just if you take it on a basic level, let's say the vast majority of people die from gun suicides in our country, which they do right now. There are certain things you could do, the industry could do, that could make guns less dangerous, that are accessible by someone who was struggling and dealing with depression. For example, a loading indicator could be on a gun. Guns could be required to have trigger pull standards, drop fire test. Guns could only be fired by the authorized user of the gun. Fingerprint recognition standards. These are things that you could require of the industry. I mean, most people's phones, you can just press on your phone and my phone is accessible by my fingerprint.
Right.
And these are things that I think when we're having conversations about guns in our country, we need to have a conversation, a fully informed dialogue, mm-hmm. and an honest dialogue about guns. Most people in our country are I would say that they respect the Second Amendment. They respect gun owners. They most people have children and family members. They will do anything to protect them and keep them safe. Right.
Yeah.
I happen to make the decision to get a dog in our house to do that. Right. Because when you ask criminals, what are they more afraid of? Guns or dogs? They say dogs. Right. At least in homes, because dogs make more noise.
I have a recording behind the door. It sounds like a dog barking.
Do you? Yeah. Is it? But those are some of the things I think we should be talking about.
And it sounds reasonable. That's what we're doing tonight. We're having a reasonable conversation. We're talking to Senator Dan Katowski. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk to Dr. Kathy Tynes from Northwestern. She's an associate professor of medicine at Northwestern. And we're going to talk to Dr. Henry Kamerling after the 11:30 news. He's a professor of history out in Seattle. He's an expert on American history. So I'm looking forward to that. And today was important for several reasons. The president met with families who are stakeholders in this situation. And there were parents of kids who died last week. There were teenagers. And we need to listen to the teenagers. I think the most remarkable thing that we're finding is that kids have a voice. And one of our favorite kids on the show has something really great to tell us. Jasmine, it's always great to hear from you. I'm not bringing you into the gun conversation. I'm bringing you into the Jasmine story conversation. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you tonight?
I'm good. I'm having this important conversation because I want you to have a safe future. And you have something to share with us. What do you want to tell us?
Today I stayed after school for baseball tryout.
Uh-huh. And?
And it went pretty well. I was mostly playing a lot of catch uh-huh. with guys on the team.
Uh-huh.
And I realized I think I catch, I'm better at fielding ground balls than catching balls in the air.
Me too. Because you have to get under it. Did you use my clamshell? Did you remember to do that to trap the ball?
Yeah, I was making sure to cup it in the glove.
Nice.
The coach let me try to hit.
Uh-huh.
I hit one after my missing 10.
That's okay. I went a whole season with missing every single pitch that came down. I used to lean into the pitch, Jasmine. I told you that, just so I could get on base.
It went to the other end of the batting cage, though. So.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, by the way, can you tell Nick D I said hi? Because I feel like he's forgotten about me.
He has not forgotten about you. I'll make sure we say hi to him for you. Okay, Jasmine?
All right, and hopefully we can meet up in the summer and we can get serious.
Yeah.
And I'm warning you, I won't be holding back.
I don't blame you. And we're going to start working on some fly balls, too, okay?
All right.
All right, Jasmine.
Hope you have a good rest of your night.
Thank you, too. Get some sleep. Go to bed.
Bye.
It's late. Bye, Jasmine. More conversation when we come back on 720 WGN. We were having a very important conversation about freedom from dying of gun wounds, gunshot wounds. I don't know any other way to say it. Is that how we have to frame it, Senator Katowski? Is I want the freedom to not die from a gunshot wound?
Well, I think it's all about whether or not we want our children to be safe, free, and secure.
Yeah,
and our families to be safe, free, and secure. And the question is right now, whose freedom is it? And there's been a debate in our country, and one side has been prevailing on one side of it, which is essentially they're saying, well, it's our liberties and it's our freedoms. And I mean, there was a time where, you know, people were able to go into the airport without going through metal detectors to the extent that they are and going through the security. And the issue is like, well, sometimes there's, as somebody pointed out, you can be an absolutist or you can acknowledge the fact that there's things that can be done and addressed, yeah, which protects your liberties while also protecting the safety and the security and the liberty of and the lives of children and families.
And this is a health issue. You are the CDC has determined that gun violence is a leading cause of death. And joining us in the studio as well is Dr. Kathy Tynes, Associate Professor of Medicine at Northwestern and President-elect of the Illinois State Medical Society. And you just came back from D.C. What were the conversations like about involving gun violence?
So, interestingly enough, a member of our delegation from Illinois State Medical Society came specifically to talk about school safety. And, you know, the shooting occurred while we were there.
Right. Mm.
So we were actually waiting to meet with Senator Bill Cassidy, and we're in the outer office, and there it is on the TV. And he had been giving the spiel to all these legislators all this whole time with, you know, kind of, I think, half-hearted listening, and Bill Cassidy was riveted. And he's talking about a study that came out of the Illinois School Safety Initiative and out of the a study they did where they looked at all these prior gun shootings or school shootings and looked for commonalities. And what they found was that there were a striking number of them. And his proposal has to do with recognizing the warning signs because they're out there. And as we saw with this latest shooter, there were clearly visible signs, motive, means, mentality. So, you know, they have a lot of things in common, stockpiling weapons, anger, hatred towards either their school, their environment, or specific bullies. They try to recruit other shooters to join them. So there's a lot of things that are visible on Facebook through their conversations. And just recognizing them and bringing them to the attention of the authorities would be one step in actually preventing these shootings.
Right.
So, you know, this doesn't have anything to do with gun rights. This just has to do with identifying potential shooters. The sad thing in this case is that this kid was identified, and
there were 39 calls to the local police department for various kinds of issues, whether it was with his parents, violence. There were neighbors that were concerned. You know, the calls to the FBI. There also didn't seem to be communication from the local police department. That didn't. I mean, if they didn't see any issue, I don't know what a tip to the FBI. What the next step would have been as well. I mean, the FBI has admitted that they should have followed through on that, but local police department as well. I mean, what has been successful?
Well, I thought an interesting proposal I had heard was the use of a firearm restraining order. So the concept is the same as a restraining order that you take out against an individual who's threatening you, where you restrict their mobility, their ability to get close to you, and their ability to contact you. Similarly, if you raise a red flag and you go to the authorities and you say, look, this person's a danger either to himself or to other people, that should enable, you would think, somebody in a position of authority to restrict their access to firearms until, you know, this gets checked out thoroughly, till you get them the help that they need. But the emphasis is on safety rather than protecting their rights. And you were talking about the Second Amendment right and how it seems to supersede all the other rights that we have. And I think the perfect example is our First Amendment rights for free speech. Those are restricted. You know, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. So, you know, where's the common sense when it comes to guns and Second Amendment rights?
See, what's interesting about that?
We have to take a break, and we're going to talk to Second Amendment. Well, we're all talking about the Second Amendment some more after the 11:30 news. We're going to have a historian on, and we'll take a note of what you want to say next, Senator.
I'm writing it down. Taking a note.
More after this on 720 WGN. According to the CDC, gun violence is a leading cause of death in the United States. Assaults by firearm kill about 13,000 people in the United States each year, which translates to roughly 1 in 315 lifetime chance of death from gun violence. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez. We are live in the Allstate Showcase studio. We've been talking to Senator Dan Katowski, Dr. Kathy Tynes, and joining us on the line is American history professor. And I'll be honest, I'm just going to tell people, I knew him from my years at the University of Illinois. He has a master's and PhD from the University of Illinois, all in history. Dr. Henry Kamerling is the author of Capital and Convict, Race, Region, and Punishment in Post-Civil War America. He's an expert on American history, in particular in the South. And Dr. Kamerling, how are you doing tonight?
Hi, Patty. I'm fine. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. And the thing that I started the show with tonight was talking about the Second Amendment. And people seem to know that it's a right to bear arms. And they kind of know that it's something about a well-regulated militia. And I'm always surprised that people don't also think of, when you hear those numbers, 1 in 315. At what point are we not saying our freedom, our rights, as stated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, how is that not somehow now being undermined by the Second Amendment? Wouldn't you think?
Well, you know, the way you put it is interesting. It's hard to say, you know, there's a tension between security and liberty that plays out in the context of, you know, all governments. And in order to form a government, we surrender a little bit of our stuff in order to purchase some of our security. The Second Amendment is no different than that.
Exactly. Hold on one second, Doctor, because I have to. Michael, let me try a different line real quick. I just want to see if it's your phone or if it's our phone. Stand by, Doc. Let me see if it's this one. Let's see if that's better. One second. No, I can't do that one. Huh. I'm having trouble with this one again. Dr. Kamerling, let me see how it sounds.
Yes.
All right. So we're talking about the Second Amendment. Yes, go ahead. We're talking about the Second Amendment. And exactly, it's one of those things where we try to understand it. What kind of arguments are you getting involved with when you see, whether it's in social media or conversations that you're having with your students when it comes to gun violence?
Well, one of the things that's really interesting about the Second Amendment, I'm sorry, I'm getting a really bad reverberation.
Okay, hold on. Let's see if we can try to fix that real quick, because I know we've been able to fix it before. Hey, Michael, let's see if we can work with engineering to straighten that one out. I don't know which line would be better for that, because I can't seem to use this one. All right, let me take Dr. Kamerling. Stand by. We're going to take one of our listeners' calls real quick and see if that one works, too. Hey, Glenn, how are you doing?
Oh, good.
Are you getting any feedback on your phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so you're getting feedback on your phone as well. Oh, no, our phones are a little bit rusty tonight. All right, what do you want to say, Glenn? Maybe we can try to get through it.
Well, first of all, when the Second Amendment was written, that was so many years ago, I don't think the forefathers expected what is happening today.
I agree.
And second, the NRA is paying all our politicians millions of dollars. And elections coming up in 18 and 20. And there's going to be probably millions of kids by then that are turning of voting age. And now, are each of the politicians going to go with the NRA and take all this money and go in their favor? Or are they going to protect their jobs when all these kids vote against them?
And that's the thing, Dr. Kamerling, I think I might have straightened that out. Are you still getting some feedback on your line?
Let's see. No, I think that sounds a lot better. Thanks.
Oh, excellent. Yes. So he just mentioned the NRA, and what are we going to do about that? I know that you have some thoughts on the NRA and their role in where we are today with gun legislation.
You know, one of the interesting things about the history of the Second Amendment is that there's, you know, a lot of the amendments to the Constitution, including the first 10, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, have generated a tremendous amount of case law over the course of their history and the life of the nation. And the case law around the Second Amendment over the
history of the country is actually pretty thin. And for the vast majority of time, all the way up until the 1970s, the debates about the Second Amendment of the Constitution and the right to bear arms all revolved around, or mostly revolved around, the tension between the federal government's power to regulate guns and states' power to regulate, to pass their own gun legislation, not a debate about the individual right to bear arms. And so that's a really interesting point to make. I think that it was, 1991, former Chief Justice Warren Burger said that the idea that the Second Amendment recognizes an individual right to gun ownership was a fraud on the public. And the consensus had been since the beginning of the life of the nation that that's not what the Second Amendment was about. And so it was really only in the early 1970s when the NRA specifically decided that it was going to try and craft an individual right to bear arms, and it engaged in a decades-long campaign to change the meaning of the Second Amendment, and it did it in a very sort of well-thought-out, well-planned, strategic way by working on hiring scholars and pushing arguments through the Supreme Court, hoping to get people appointed to the federal judgeship and to the Supreme Court that agreed with their interpretation of the Constitution. And so this whole debate that's happening about the NRA, you know, where we are now, most people today, like you said initially, say, oh, yeah, the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. But that's a very new, that's a sort of since the 1970s development. That traditionally, we haven't, the country has not actually thought that that's what the Second Amendment was about. So the NRA has been very successful in changing the way that everybody in the nation thinks, not just sort of conservatives and not just Republicans, but the nation at large. People walk around thinking, oh, yeah, we have a right to bear arms as individuals. And that tension between an individual right to bear arms or whether to protect a state's right to organize a military institution called a militia, like that's the debate that we've been having. But it's really only a debate that's happened, still only been a powerful cultural and political debate in the last 20 or 30 years of the nation. And the NRA has been very successful in getting its point of view across.
Senator, I know you wanted to, you're nodding the whole time. You're like, yes, yes.
No, I agree completely because when you look at some of the rulings that have been out there, none of these laws really that have anything to do with addressing the prevalence of assault weapons in our society or laws regarding background checks or laws regarding cracking down on person-to-person sales or even laws regarding preventing people from owning machine guns have ever been struck down on Second Amendment grounds. You know, the issues that have been where the courts have not so been favorable has been not necessarily dealing with some of these regulations, but like when Chicago had a handgun ban, right? And, you know, what's interesting to me is like I've had this discussion this week and they're like, oh, Chicago, people say Chicago is just an example of how gun laws don't work. Well, Chicago is surrounded by a sea of gun dealers. In the suburbs and throughout the rest of the state and nearby states. And that's the struggle that Chicago faces in stemming the flow of illegal guns. But no regulations regarding gun dealers, if we improved and enhanced them, have ever been struck down. So it's interesting how that discussion has shifted and how people say, well, look, you know, that component of the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia, is not really what they were talking about. They were talking about regulations or being well-regulated. They're just talking, quite frankly, about the right of people to keep and bear arms. But I think sometimes when we have this discussion, we just don't really factor into the fact that this is a right that people have. But what's going on here is there's an industry that's basically foisting upon the American public what it wants to see happen with the guns that it produces. And the American people, quite frankly, because of the way the industry doesn't have the type of regulations that other industry does, that's the challenge that we face. And it's a huge struggle because most people don't look at, they have this discussion about individuals are right, but they don't talk about the industry. They don't talk about regulations on the industry. They don't talk about the fact that they're exempt from lawsuits. They don't talk about the fact they're exempt from any kind of recall for defective firearms that are made. They don't talk about any of that because they want to have the discussion about the individual in the gun as opposed to what the industry is doing and how the industry, which has the lobby, which is the NRA, is pushing their agenda and how your guns over time have, for lack of a better word, evolved. They're more dangerous, they're more powerful, they're more efficient killing machines than they ever have been. And it's because there isn't that regulation on the industry. The industry can produce what it wants to produce, right? And unlike you can't, we talked about a tank. I can't drive down the street with a tank.
You kind of want to, though, don't you?
Yeah, right now, but I can, I could, a rubber tank, but I can drive that. A 50 caliber sniper rifle, people can buy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Dr. Cameron, go ahead. Yes, sir.
I was just going to say, it's interesting, in the 2008 ruling, District of Columbia versus Howard, which the conservative Supreme Court Justice Scalia found an individual right to bear arms in that Supreme Court decision, that overturned, decades or centuries of jurisprudence. But even in the Heller decision, he left open the idea that that he, Scalia, and the conservative justices on the Supreme Court held open the idea that you're not free to carry any arm, any kind of arm at any time. And so not only can you not drive down the streets of Chicago in a tank, you also can't carry a bazooka. Right? Like, there are lots of weapons that you could be banned, even given the individual right to bear arms as a constitutional right. My interpretation of the Second Amendment is that it does not grant an individual right to bear arms. But even if you did, I think there's still a lot of common sense regulation on industries, on manufacturers, on type of weapons, on the ways that they're produced, on safety locks. A lot of people, a lot more wise about policy than I am, could produce a whole bunch of legislation that would be completely permissible, even under the Heller decision, which grants an individual right to bear arms.
Isn't it amazing? We have to take a break here, but isn't it amazing how successful the NRA has been in creating this culture of people identifying with their weaponry? And we don't seem to be able to have a culture of being able, like, I don't know, I guess you can't have like a kindness lobby or a celebrate life lobby. Let's take a break here. More conversation. I know that I'm going to check with Glenn, and we have Tucker Rich on the line. The calls are coming in. 312-981-7200. We do have the phone lines open. Dr. Henry Kamerling joins us on the line. Dr. Kathy Tynes in studio, and Senator Dan Katowski, who's also now the president and CEO of ChildServe. More in a moment on 720 WGN. According to the National Safety Council, being shot is a common way to die in the United States. We are talking about gun violence, about regulation, about safety. We are talking to Dr. Kathy Tynes, Senator Dan Katowski, now the president and CEO of ChildServe. I know your calls are coming in. We also have on the line with us Dr. Henry Kamerling. He has a PhD in history, his master's and PhD in history from the University of Illinois, ILLINI. I had to say that. So, Dr. Kamerling, one of the things that you and I will sometimes be on social media, get into conversations with people, maybe post links to stories. I do feel like this is a time, the weirdest thing right now is it feels like historians had to put a cape on. For the first time, we're like, wait a minute, that's not what happened, or here's what actually happened. And I know you want to talk a little bit about the Second Amendment and its role in race and slavery in our history.
Well, thank you, Patty, so much. I do feel like, one of the things that I'll say to my historian friends is that I feel like we're suffering through a period of profound historical illiteracy. It's a challenge for historians who work in very kind of refined areas and to communicate effectively and openly with the public at large and to, correct misperceptions about history, and there are a lot of them. One of the interesting things, for example, about the Second Amendment is that in the debates over the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, the debates that produced the 1787 Constitution, which is our Constitution, and then the debates over the Bill of Rights, which were amended and ratified in 1791, most of those debates about the Second Amendment focused on the concept of what a militia was and the institutions of militias and their relationship to both individual state governing power and authority and the authority of the federal government. And so it's very clear if you go back and take the time, as I'm sure many of your listeners do, to read the debates in the Constitutional Convention or read the debates about the 1791 Bill of Rights to see how prevalent the debate over this notion of what a militia is and what its function in society is. And most of the impetus for the Second Amendment came actually from Southern states who were very concerned that the federal government might assume a new police power in organizing a national army that would obviate or diminish individual state militias. And for southern states, individual state militias meant slave patrol. And so at the insistence, particularly of states like Virginia, there was a real effort to say we need a Second Amendment right to bear arms for a well-regulated militia in order to make sure that we keep our slave patrols, even if the federal government decides to move in a different direction at some later point. So the debates about the Second Amendment had a lot to do with the race and slavery as it played out in the new nation.
Wow. I it's funny. I'm looking around the studio. We're like, okay. I mean, I think we do need to go back and read that. We have a listener on the line who wants to join a conversation. I want to thank Glenn. I know he was hanging on for a bit. I was going to come back to calls. I swear I was, Glenn. Trucker Rich, what did you want to say? Hey, Trucker Rich.
Hey, how you doing? I thought you said Glenn. I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
I'm doing all right tonight.
Oh, it's good to hear your voice, sir.
You know, the Second Amendment was written back when a good marksman could get off two shots a minute. And with an AR, you know, with an M16 or an AK-47, you can get off like 40 to 60 shots a minute, depending on how fast you can change clips. But the bigger issue, I think, is the term assault rifle. I think we ought to be working towards, besides, you know, more gun control, the regulation on semi-automatics, because if you look it up, a Ruger Mini 14 fires the same rounds as a M16 AR-16, but they don't look anywhere near as scary.
Right.
You know.
Right. They're like handguns.
The assault term just makes it sound scarier. And, you know, so you just don't need to, right. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, they're semi-automatics, correct? Yeah, and they're not, I mean, and again, we were talking about the types of guns that they had when the Second Amendment was written, and we can go on and on about how long it took to load a musket, but, you know, the bolt, even if you went with a bolt action, that you see all these photos of people saying, oh, in the 50s, we took guns to school.
It's the high-capacity ammunition magazines which really makes these guns more dangerous.
Well, by the way, before we go to the break, and I want to thank Dr. Kamerling for joining us and everybody in the studio. I don't know if you guys saw, but when Donald Trump said that he wanted to ban bump stocks, the price went up because all the gun companies were like, you better buy one now. Hurry up and buy your weapons of mass destruction. So anyway, this is the madness we're living in. Dr. Kamerling, we'd love to have you on at your earliest convenience and talk about your book. Everyone can find Capital. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'd love it. That'd
yes,
be great.
Please go to Barnes & Noble. Go everywhere we can find a book. Capital and Convict, Race, Region, and Punishment in Post-Civil War America by Dr. Henry Kamerling. Have a great night. Feel better, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. More with our guests when we come back on 720 WGN.